Welcome to Garden DC, a podcast of Washington Gardener magazine all about gardening in the greater Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic area. Your host is Kathy Gents, editor of Washington Gardener magazine. This episode, we chat with Kit Gage, a Chesapeake Bay landscape professional who is active in several local groups, including the Friends of Sligo Creek and the Tacoma Horticultural Club. I'm going to jump right in. And the first thing we wanted to talk about was the recent Green Matters conference that Brookside Gardens held on February 21st. The theme of this year's Green Matters was solutions for ecologically sustainable landscapes, which I think is right up your alley, Kit.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, as per usual, it was sold out with a long wait list. So it's a much in-demand conference. They get some great speakers every year. So if you have not been to Green Matters and you're in the D.C. area, look out for the announcement of next Green Matters, probably towards the end of December, is when they start taking reservations, and sign up as soon as you see it.
Yep.
Definitely. So I am going to jump in. Our next issue, March issue of Washington Gardener magazine, we're going to have a little summary of some of the talks at Green Matters, but I wanted to get some of your take on it, Kit, as well. Sure. Starting with the keynote speaker, Roy Diblick of, I think it's Northwood Nurseries. I think I'm saying it right. Outside of Madison, Wisconsin.
Right. I think so. Or else Northern Illinois. It was, grew up in Northern Illinois. So he's been in that area for mm-hmm. I was interested in all the topics on this conference. And just to sort of back up a second, mm-hmm. as you say, and as I was saying, the horticulture industry and theory as well has gone through really a massive transformation. And one of the things that this conference has been useful for over time is to really exemplify it and lead the way in talking about how differently things should be done. So starting with somebody like Roy, who has a somewhat relatively laissez-faire, I'd say, approach to planting. He says, look at your plant. You know, if you're choose a few plants and look at those plants, make sure they're planted in the right place in terms of soil and conditions, but figure out what grows fast and what it eventually grows to be, and then plant accordingly. So it's not it's completely rational thinking, but it goes against, mm-hmm. sort of against the grain of planting everything up in neat rows and in everything all at once, and just planting shrubs on every 3 feet and planting perennials every 1 foot, and it doesn't matter what plant it is.
Mm-hmm.
So he also talked about having paying attention to aggressive plants. It wasn't that he was against them. He just said, give the other plants a fair shot at growing by planting the ones that don't grow too aggressively first, so they can get established. And then if you want to, go ahead and plant those aggressive ones sort of underneath them.
Yeah, I love what Roy said about that. And I thought that was a great theory to give the, I don't want to call them weaker plants, but the more gentle, let's call them.
Well, the ones that grow,
yes.
Really that, it's growth rate.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the ones that grow slower and have a little bit of a slower start, give them a head start, literally, of 2 or 3 years, and then fill in with some of those more aggressive plants that you might love to have in your garden. I also love that he said to limit your plant palette so drastically. He said 8 to 9 plants in different combinations is really all you need. And for somebody who, like me, is a diehard plant collector, I was like, oh, that's going to be tough, Roy.
Yeah, and I'm actually sure I completely agree with that. I mean, I think that's mm-hmm. in general not a bad idea, as long as everybody doesn't plant the same 9 plants. Because then you get emerald ash borer and you're sunk.
Exactly. Yeah. But so my choice of 8 to 9 favorites or obviously would be different from yours. And then he says to get to know 20 plants in depth. And I thought that was another great point, just to get to know their growth rate, what they look like as seedlings, should they reseed and you want to move them somewhere. So I think a lot of us gardeners are guilty of not knowing a lot about a few plants, but a little about a lot of plants.
And I don't think he was real explicit, but I think he was certainly emphasized, like most of the folks in the Green Matters, emphasizing using native plants where you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I thought that was really nice that he gave the option that if you loved, you know, a certain plant that was aggressive, that this is one way to have it and be able to control it and still have a pretty good ecologically beneficial landscape. Right.
Plus, he also says just the only two inputs he has in the garden are water and leaf mulch.
I love that because I'm a lazy gardener and I'm never scheduling a fertilization, especially of woody plants. I'm like, I feel like that's a waste of money and time for most woody plants. As long as they're getting that leaf mulch or some organic input, top dressing, depending on the area you live in, you might not have access to leaf mulch, but you know, something for their root zone, but certainly doesn't need to be an artificial fertilization.
Absolutely.
So on to the next speaker of the day was Urban and Suburban Meadows, Catherine Zimmerman, who is a documentarian and has written a book by the same title. And her mission is transforming lawns into environmentally friendly habitats. And I love her story kit that she freely admits that she was like an all chem lawn person, that she was just at all the inputs to make a green lawn possible. And then one day her eyes were opened.
We were all trained that way. And it's been a fascinating evolution that not everybody has joined yet. But certainly in the trade, and for example, I mean, look at Montgomery County, where now lawn pesticides have been prohibited.
And that's like such a revolution in just the last decade, if not the last generation.
Right. And she goes beyond that. And, you know, there's a bunch of folks who were working on this issue. She went beyond that, talking about how you then plant a meadow. But the comparison is dramatic. If you look at a soil depth, compare a lawn, especially something like sort of the golf course is the prime example, a golf course lawn compared with a meadow. If you look underground, a lawn will typically have roots about as high as deep as the grass is high. So the roots are going to be an inch or 2 inches maybe, which doesn't go anywhere and doesn't give the plant much to grow with. And certainly doesn't help the soil. And if you look at a meadow, often you'll have the roots going down 2 or 3 feet, which gives those plants, gives the soil a lot more stability.
And obviously absorbing rainwater and runoff, of course.
I've seen this a lot doing stormwater work, that often if you've got especially in new build areas where they've, all the heavy equipment's been there, they topped, they just grind the soil down so it's completely compacted clay, then they'll stick they'll either plant seed it or plant turf, and basically the water runs over the top of where that clay is, and the grass all dies.
Definitely. I love Catherine's phrase for it, which is green concrete.
No, that's what you can see. You can see the rain just running down a lawn. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a rainstorm.
And I think that really evokes the image there of that. Any other takeaways from Catherine's talk before we move on to the next set of speakers?
Well, the only thing she says what I think is generally good advice, which is limit your lawn, eliminate it if you can. Recognizing that not everybody understands what it is you're doing. If you mow the edge, it looks like your meadow is intentional.
That's a great point
of selling it to the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people are comfortable walking by a sidewalk, as long as it's 2 or 3 feet back of the start of the meadow, that they're fine with that the edges are the important part for suburban habitats. Yep. And then, so our next speaker, that after lunch, they had that hard time slot. Woo, I don't envy them. So that was Craig Russell and Paul Mills on regenerative approach to sustainable landscapes. And they were coming from a design viewpoint. So a little bit higher level and showing some really fascinating projects that they have worked on across the country.
Right. You know, and they were coming from, I think, Colorado Springs, which is a really dry, you know, really arid area. I think they said 14 inches of rain a year, which...
Yeah, that
and, you know, and they're not talking about watering. So
no,
the palette of plants that you have to work with is very specific, and they worked with it, and they ended up with some really beautiful projects in Colorado Springs. But they've been working there also for a period of years, so they got a chance, as I think is very useful for designers, to see what worked. So they can go, they can see stuff that was 5 or 10 years old and say, oh, right, well, that plant worked great, but this other plant maybe not so well. Let's see what we can do.
Yeah, and the one project they showed, a college campus, not only has the impacts of, you know, hard Colorado climates, but also, of course, of college students and foot traffic and needing to look good pretty much year round, because you want to sell that college to the parents that are coming on tours and obviously make life nice for students there as well. So I thought some of those, their little seating areas and courtyards with shade seating on onto one side, but a little meadow planting to the other, were really nicely done. I think the project that they showed that most pertains to the DC area would be the one they did of the campus of, and I'm just forgetting the name of the drink company outside of Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah, and
it's a beer company. And they said they get 44 inches of rain there, as opposed to the 14 in Colorado Springs. And it was right along the river that runs alongside Asheville, and was on an old industrial site. And that's what was really fascinating to me. I love to see that regeneration of industrial sites and adaptive new reuse, and how green it had become in just like the 5 or 10 years that they've done this project.
Yeah, it was just beautiful. And, you know, of course, often with industrial sites that are on, they put them on the water in the olden days so that they could dump all this, the waste into the water. That now being illegal, but the landscapers could switch it out so that all of a sudden the plant and then the visitor center could relate it to the water, and you could see it, you could relax next to it. It was part of the design instead of you know, an afterthought.
And I love their like literal beer garden,
right?
Like literally get to sit there on the river and enjoy it now. So then the last speaker of the day was Rebecca McMakin or McMakin. I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly. Embracing ecological gardening methods to create functional ecosystems, which is a mouthful. But basically she talked about the Brooklyn Bridge Park.
Yeah, which is, so it's obviously right on, it's right on the river, and it was a series of old docking areas, and they were just ugly and awful, and they planted them up very densely with, I guess, I mean, it reminded me a little bit of the High Line in Manhattan, but not, I mean, it was just more blobs than a long line. But it was fascinating to see. I mean, they use all. It look. I think they're using all native plants, and bare, but very dense. And I think didn't they haul in a bunch of soil because there was nothing there?
It's all infill and landfill, just built up on those old piers and the old dumpings that had been there, and the fact that they're on this this wildlife line that are coming down each season, actually each year, And they're keeping track of which birds are coming through, which wildlife is coming through. And in the 5 to 10 years that the project has been in creation, it's fascinating to see how many wild animals and all the varieties of species that have come back to this little super, super urban hemmed in little park.
Right. And it's, I mean, there, it's a fair amount of land relatively to plant, but on the other hand, it is tiny. They're tiny. And mm-hmm. if you're a bird on the, you know, flying through, you've got to be really, you've got to use your magnifying glass to see it, but they're finding it, and it's, and butterflies and every, you know, everything. It's just remarkable what, you know, what it tells you about regeneration.
Mm-hmm. And it, I think the big difference between this and the Highline would be it's a little wilder and a little more shady in that there's more tree habitat. Right. In the Brooklyn Park, Bridge Park. And what I loved was how she talked about everything that's created there as far as what they grow when they cut back their grasses at the end of winter. They just chop them up and kind of hide them under the beds of shrubs and under trees. So everything stays on site, right. Pretty much.
And they're, you know, and they're not bringing in, wood chips and other, they're not bringing stuff in at all. It's, you know, they're not mulching it around to make it look, lovely in quotes in the way that is also somewhat the standard right now.
Mm-hmm. But still is lovely from the photos she showed. And I cannot wait to get up to New York to visit it myself in person.
Me too.
That's going to be great. And what one takeaway I got from her was how they hid things from the visitors. So if you tromped back, say, behind a shrub or tree, you might find some of the detritus from the garden. But it was all kind of hidden and tucked away in there. I thought that was fabulous.
It's a lot cheaper, too.
Exactly. I'm like, I'm going to hide more stuff under shrubs in my garden. Okay, so that was a wonderful day at Green Matters and always worthwhile and lots of takeaways for home gardeners and professionals. So we highly recommend attending that conference. So swiveling to our next topic, which are two fairly recent books, one of which, The Overstory, a novel by Richard Powers, we just discussed with the Washington Gardener Magazine's Garden Book Club. And so I wanted to get some of your thoughts on that, Kit. And then Nature's Best Hope by Doug Tallamy will be our next pick for the Washington Gardener Magazine Garden Book Club. This spring we'll be discussing it as a group, but I have you, and thank you very much for reviewing it in our next issue. So let's start with The Overstory, which is a novel, and it's been on the bestseller list for weeks and weeks. It's won several prizes, and lots of book clubs are tackling it, not just eco or garden book clubs like mine. What was your overall impression of The Overstory?
Well, it's sort of what you were saying, which is that it's a lot of people are reading it beyond people who, you know, read Doug Tallamy, for example. Mm-hmm. that, and it's obviously a love story about trees that weaves in lots of different characters and lots of different stories that are sort of based on real life, but then, well, you know, but not with the characters to whom they occurred. So it's so it's interesting in that way and a little bit irritating to me, but I really it's a little bit difficult read because there's so many characters and they're from so many different places and you have to remember what happened to who and who's this again. But after you get going into it, you can follow it. But the love of trees and the kind of I think of it as a little bit subversive, teaching people, for example, things like how trees and other growing things interact in terms of the soil, talking about the fungal life of the soil and how it facilitates the growth of a forest, so that if you cut down the forest and rip up the ground, you've done more than just cut down those trees. You've made it so that a new forest is going to have a really terrible time regrowing. Now, those kinds of lessons mm-hmm. that are completely factual and have real resonance with the tree growing industry and the tree cutting industry.
Definitely. And I love the way he, you know, folds the stories of the different characters together. So they just come together at a certain point. I'm not spoiling anything since it is a novel, but he does slip in so much tree research and knowledge yeah. in there that you don't even know that you're learning while you're learning. And it's such a pleasure to read because he does have a great way with a turn yeah. of phrase. So it is not a short read. So if you are choosing it for your book club, warn people that they need to start it more than 2 days before the book club meets.
Right.
you will not be finishing it.
To read yep. it as a book than as a, you know, have it read to you in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it should be, but it's not something you're going to sit down and read in one setting. So yeah. And that's why I think helps to absorb it a little bit of time as well. And I think the fact that it is getting such high praise and such great reach to non-gardeners or non-tree huggers is obviously a great thing and a great sign that a book like this is getting such big popularity.
Yep, I agree.
So on to Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard. By Douglas W. Tallamy, or as we know him, Doug.
Yeah.
So this is our next choice for our garden book club, but it is not a fiction book, so no spoilers here. But this is the third book, I believe, by Doug Tallamy, who is an entomologist at the University of Delaware, and who does frequent talks and courses in the greater DC area. So if you haven't seen one of his talks, definitely look out for that in a local public garden or any opportunity you can get to listen to Doug talk. Maybe even on YouTube, you can find a couple of videos of him speaking. Definitely check those out. So what was your impression of Nature's Best Hope?
Like a lot of people who will probably read this book, I've read his other books and heard him speak a couple times at least. And for his first book, I felt a little like he was laying out what he thinks is going to happen from the studies that they're doing at Delaware. But he didn't have, mm-hmm. he didn't have conclusions. And I felt with this last book, more like that data has been filled in. And just to sort of back up and say what I'm talking about, if you haven't read any books, his central point is that if we want to save birds, and he's really talking about any birds, you have to make sure that there are caterpillars in the trees, because baby birds don't eat seeds and hard things. They eat soft, mushy things, which are caterpillars. So you have to figure out where the caterpillars are in the trees. And that's what he's increasingly found is they're in pretty much just in native trees native to an area, and but more particularly in particular species of trees. So I'm not spoiling this new book.
Leaves. So home gardeners obviously need to tolerate some little bite marks out of their leaves, because without those bite marks and those little caterpillars, we're not going to have birds.
Yeah, not just tolerate it, but recognize that the only way you're going to have birds and all the benefits that birds provide, not just to humans but to everything, how important a part of the biome they are.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to not spray those trees, and you've got to, yeah, you've if you know you've got holes in the trees, you say, oh good, that's good, I've got caterpillars. that the birds have something to feed their babies so that there will be a new generation of birds.
For sure. I remember the first time I walked out and saw my little baby redbud tree had perfect little holes cut in each leaf. And I said, who did this? But of course, my first instinct was not to spray, but to find out first what this was. And then I saw the little leaf cutter bees and I was very pleased. And it was such a symmetrical little pattern that it was cute. But yeah.
And he really, I mean, he really, he's done now the studies that that show that basically almost no non-native plants around the Mid-Atlantic will support caterpillars. They don't, they don't recognize those leaves as food. So they recognize just native leaves as food, and not just native leaves of any old native tree, but very particular ones. For example, oaks are the primo species that support the greatest number of different kinds of caterpillars. So
yeah,
the idea, you know, he says, go plant yourself a white oak. So I anticipate everyone should go out and plant a white oak. I'm going to go plant a white oak. One of my trees has died and I've got a little room. I'm going to plant a white oak.
Yeah, you do need a little bit of room, but if you have that room and you have a choice of trees, that's the white oak, and then maybe the southern red oak would probably be your next choice down the list for that.
I might do a red oak instead. But we'll see. We'll see what.
Yep.
But the primo example of how difficult this can be is black cherries. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to plant a black cherry tree, and you never see them planted because in the spring, they are just loaded with tent caterpillars.
Yes. They are unsightly.
Because of that.
Yes.
But on the other hand, if you've got a forest situation where you can kind of put up with that and recognize that that's, they're doing a really important service, almost never will you see a black cherry that dies as a result of the tent caterpillars. They don't die. They can look like they're going to die. And then they, you know, after the spring, they leaf out and seem to do just fine.
And another thing that I noticed about his new book is Nature's Best Hope is that there are plenty of color photographs showing you examples of the birds in habitat, some of the plantings you can do, and the different moth drops that you might find, say, in your leaf litter over the winter time. So if you found like a little egg case or something, you would be able to recognize that. So I love that. I believe in his first book, it was all text. So having some photographs to guide people is really helpful.
Right. And I can't, because I've gone to all these conferences and read all these books, I can't remember which one it is, but it's in one of these things that we just discussed. The current recommendation is that you, to the extent possible, you should not rake your leaves. You should leave them where they are in your garden. And often you'll find, like, if you have a little bit of lawn, like I do, not very much, but a little bit, usually the wind will blow the leaves off of your lawn. And the rest of the areas where you've got other kinds of planting, certainly underneath trees, but in your perennial beds, don't rake the leaves. Just leave them go, because there's so many things, spiders and, as you say, various kinds of chrysalis and other things are living in that leaf litter, and you start raking it or even shredding it, especially shredding it, you will kill them off and destroy that habitat.
And if you live in a HOA, a homeowners association, or something that requires leaf removal, hand raking, maybe into a pile in the back, or tucked in some side area, is probably the best recommendation you can do. Avoid leaf blowers at all costs, because that's definitely going to carry away all the beneficials that were in your yard.
And not to mention some topsoil.
And some of your great topsoil as well.
Yeah.
So wrapping up here, I think that we'd recommend reading, of course, both books. It sounds like positive reviews for both.
Oh, yeah.
And Nature's Best Hope, if you didn't read his previous books, don't feel like you need to catch up. I think you could jump in straight with this one.
Yeah.
It's almost like more of a handbook for the home gardener. So something that you could give as a gift to somebody who might be considering converting their yard to more of a wildlife habitat. this would be probably a great first step for them.
Absolutely, I agree.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kit, for joining me on this podcast episode and for writing the review of Nature's Best Hope, which we'll look out for in the next issue. And I'm looking forward to discussing it with a whole garden book club, which is open to anybody in the world to attend our garden book club. And it's free. It takes place in downtown Tacoma Park, actually on the Tacoma, D.C. side of the line next to the Tacoma Metro Station. We usually meet at the Supergirl restaurant and soup place. And I'll be announcing the date for that soon on our blog and Facebook page. And thank you again, Kit. Just before we let you go, I was going to ask you what's blooming and what's happening in your garden.
Ooh, well, everything's blooming. No, actually, the snowdrops, there's a little bit of snowdrop action still happening. The winter aconites are finished. But I just saw a bloodroot blooming.
Nice.
Yeah. The trillium are in serious bud. The cuneatum, the red trillium with the mottled leaves. I think the Jeffersonia and some other little spring ephemerals are coming up. I just saw lungwort starting to bloom.
Huh.
A red bud is went from nothing to very serious budding yesterday.
Wow. I think looking at my what's blooming when weekly charts that I've done in past years, I'm going to estimate that we're at least 2 weeks ahead of schedule.
I think so.
And in some cases, 4 weeks ahead of where the normal bloom time is. I know that the few trilliums I have usually don't even start to show above the soil before mid-April.
Right. No. So, right. Not to mention, of course, the hellebores that have been blooming their little heads off for weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually at this point in mid-March, I'm dying to see anything in bloom. So it's amazing how much is already out there and opening up in our gardens.
Yeah, a little scary.
It's a little scary. Mm-hmm. So the weeds also have obviously gotten ahead of us. So there's a lot of the little guys out there that you need to grab. So the henbit and creeping Charlie, all of that you need to grab because it's already starting to bloom. And once it's gone to seed, it's pretty much a situation of all is lost. You've got, 10,000
I'm already with all is lost with creeping
Charlie
anyway.
The henbit has already seeded for you.
No, the creeping Charlie is. I'm just saying, creeping Charlie has won.
Oh no!
Yeah,
but
lasagna gardening and everything.
Exactly. So you'll have to either have a nice little ground cover, or get some chickens in there,
there
to clean that up. All right. Well, thank you again, Kit, and thank you to my listeners and. Hopefully you are out there in the garden this weekend. Even with our current coronavirus quarantine, we could at least be individually out there enjoying our own gardens.
Absolutely.
And stay healthy. Yes. And stay healthy and safe, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Plant profile, sweet alyssum. Sweet alyssum is named for its light, honey-like fragrance, though you may never notice it, because it is only a few inches high. Its short stature makes it a good choice for the very front of borders. Equally at home in hanging baskets as it is in rock gardens, sweet alyssum is a wonderful addition to your cool season annual palette, along with pansies, violas, ornamental cabbages and kales, and snapdragons. It is a great shoulder season plant for those times of the year, mid to late autumn and early spring, when you want a touch of color in the garden while you go about your outdoor tasks. It comes in white, pink, and purple blooms. The dainty flowers are a favorite of bees, butterflies, and even hummingbirds. Sweet alyssum grows easily from seed or purchased plants. You can plant it in March and shear it back when summer's heat sets in, and then see it come back full force in October. Alternatively, you can plant it in the fall and leave it to set seed and self-sow about the garden the following spring. If it plants itself where you don't want it, it's easily pulled up. It is very low care, There is no need to fertilize it. Occasionally, I will pinch back any spent stems to encourage continual blooming. Sweet Alyssum, you can grow that. You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.